Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. To begin, I met with Dr. Tom Lynch, who was the discussant of an ASCO plenary presentation of what could be viewed as the paper of the year in this disease, the FLEX study, evaluating cetuximab plus chemotherapy in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer. And Dr. Lynch began our conversation by commenting on the trial design.
This was a randomized trial in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer, randomized to chemotherapy alone with cisplatin and vinorelbine, or chemotherapy plus cetuximab given weekly. The key selection criteria in FLEX, which is different than a number of other trials which have been done, is that patients were selected on the basis of having positive staining by immunohistochemistry for EGFR. So they were EGFR positive. And the criteria that the study used was that at least one cell had to be EGFR positive, which was a fairly liberal criteria, and it ended up excluding about 15% of patients who did not have this EGFR positivity. What they found was that there was a statistically significant difference in terms of response rate favoring the group that receives cetuximab. And most importantly, survival was prolonged, with median survival going from approximately 10.1 months to approximately 11.3 months with chemotherapy and cetuximab. Interestingly, progression-free survival was no different between the two arms, and that was a big surprise because people usually expect progression-free survival to trend in the same direction as overall survival. So I think most people would agree that this was an important but somewhat modest benefit from the first study of cetuximab in this setting. In my discussion, I raised a couple of issues in terms of where we are with the drugs at this point. I think the first one is, should we be using immunohistochemistry staining? I think in the future, we probably will get away from that. However, right now, when you look at a study which has such a close margin of benefit, I think following the entrance criteria are important. And so I think IHC is something I'll be doing in my practice to exclude patients who may not benefit. I think it really raised the question of who really does benefit from this drug. We have a number of important leads. The first is perhaps EGFR by FISH will turn out to be an important criteria for picking who might benefit. Second thing is maybe this will be like colorectal cancer and that having a RAS mutation might predict who doesn't do well. But Neil, I'd say one of the key things I'm not sure of is I think 6 months ago I was pretty certain it would go the same way as colon cancer, that RAS would be a powerful negative predictor. I'm not quite as sure now, just because when you look prospectively, the number of cases that really are RAS mutant seems to be no more than 20%. So we may be stuck in a number situation that we just don't have enough power to show important differences.
Now, what had been done previously in terms of looking at cetuximab in this situation, and you had a trial that wasn't positive?
So before FLEX, there were several randomized phase twos, one from Europe with cisplatin-avalbine, one from Canada with cisplatin-gemcitabine, that both showed response rate benefit, slight benefit in terms of progression-free survival, and pretty consistent survival benefits. So the study that I presented at World Lung last September in Seoul was a randomized phase 3 trial comparing carbotaxol to carbotaxol and cetuximab. This was a North American study with good participation from around the United States, and the patients were reflective of our North American patients. They also were treated with carbotaxol, which is the most commonly used regimen still in the United States. In our trial, we found the same response rate benefit that had been seen in FLEX and in other trials, but we did not see a progression-free survival benefit. Again, similar to FLEX. Unfortunately, our study was powered for progression-free survival, and because we didn't see that benefit, it is a negative study. We're awaiting the survival data, which hasn't yet matured.
And in looking at the study, if it does turn out, if it kind of plays out that, you know, when the data's all in, that it doesn't have an advantage, what would be the potential reasons? I guess one, obviously, is the chemo's different.
So the chemo's different is one possible reason. The second reason, they weren't selected by IHC. And so that lack of selection may be just enough to make the study not necessarily be positive. I would think those are probably the two most likely explanations.
What's your thought in terms of the explanation of why a progression-free survival advantage was not seen with FLEX?
As the discussant for the paper, I struggled with that a lot in terms of how to interpret that. I asked several notable statisticians, none of whom really had any great answers for me in terms of what this could be. Some talked about maldistribution of non-proportional risks, which was something I couldn't understand. But I think it's something which we're left with as a real unknown. If you ask me what I think the most likely explanation is, there's probably differences was in imbalances in what people got for second line therapy. And so that might have influenced the overall survival versus the progression-free survival. But it's still something that's not entirely comforting in the end, because if you look at the actual numbers, there's really not enough of that imbalance to explain this.
What's your take on the practical clinical implication of these data in terms of actually using cetuximab off study?
So practically, I think cetuximab will be a drug that's going to see use in non-small cell lung cancer. I think that patients and doctors want options that improve outcome. I think cetuximab plus chemotherapy does improve outcome, similar to the way that bevacizumab plus chemotherapy improves outcome. And I think you're going to see use of both drugs. I think you'll see bevacizumab used in the quote-unquote Bev-eligible patients. And I think you'll see cetuximab used in those patients where bevacizumab isn't an option. I think with increasing time, as we learn more about which biomarkers select who might benefit from cetuximab, it might even broaden the group of patients who get treated with cetuximab.
Now, I met with Dr. Perker, who presented these data at ASCO, and he tried to convince me of the positive benefit-risk ratio of cetuximab in Bev-eligible patients. What are your thoughts about that?
My thoughts are that right now, I still think bevacizumab is a good drug. I think that American oncologists have shown a remarkable ability to use it safely. And I think when you look at some of the data that was presented at ASCO this year, the PI of a study called the ARES study, which is a registry trial of thousands of patients who've been treated with chemotherapy with Avastin. And one of the notable points is that the toxicity reports on the ARES study are consistently better than what was seen in either 4599 or AVAIL. And I think what it's showing is that practicing docs are picking the right patients to use bevacizumab with. And I think if you do that, you're seeing the drug that is safe and a drug that is active in patients with lung cancer. So I'm not so certain that we can necessarily give up on Avastin or bevacizumab at this point. I think what Dr. Perker may be referring to is that if you look at the subset of Caucasian patients with adenocarcinoma who are treated with cetuximab, the benefit looks similar to what one sees in 4599. But that's not a head-to-head comparison, so I think one has to be a bit cautious. I think one of the real questions, Neil, is how do we use both of them? And that's what the SWOG will be looking at in a randomized trial, where they ask a cetuximab and bevacizumab question.
What's the actual design of that study?
So that study is currently before the NCI, so there's always the possibility that it may get hung up in regulatory, or that there may be new safety data that emerges that would make one reconsider it. But for now, the design is if you're Bev-eligible, you're randomized to carboplatin, paclitaxel, Bev, or carboplatin, paclitaxel, Bev, and cetuximab. If you're Bev-ineligible, you're randomized to chemotherapy with carboplatin, paclitaxel, or carboplatin, paclitaxel, cetuximab. So basically a confirmatory study for carboplatin, paclitaxel, but most importantly, in the Bev-eligible population, one will learn whether two antibodies is better than one.
Now, there's an intergroup study in colon cancer out there looking at the same question. Of course, there they have data looking at the combination of cetuximab and bevacizumab, as well as panitumumab and bevacizumab, and a little bit discouraging or concerning data. What are your thoughts about that and potential applications to this lung study?
So I think the biggest implications of that are the PACE study that you're referring to, which suggests that there was some increased toxicity. I won't be doing this off of protocol until I get a pretty good sense that it's A, safe, and B, some evidence of efficacy. So I think this is the kind of data that would cause doctors to pause before doing something like this in the non-protocol setting.
You know, I guess I never know how to get into the issue of cost and reimbursement, because we sort of try to focus on clinical science, but yet obviously it's a major factor of life. And that was something you commented on in the discussion.
So I was specifically asked by the chair of the plenary session to comment on cost. And part of me didn't want to, because I actually agree with you that I think that our job as clinical investigators and as doctors is to not factor cost into the treatment choices. We should be making treatment choices for our patients based on what we think is the most efficacious and safe therapy for our patients. But when one does look at the cost is quite substantial to cetuximab added to chemotherapy for a benefit which is modest, to put it into perspective. And so I think one of the ways we get around the cost issue is to try to better refine who benefits from the drug. Because if we can better select who benefits, you have a population of patients who are more likely to see an improvement in survival, and then you're treating slightly fewer patients, so the cost becomes more cost effective. So I think that's probably the way we answer the cost question, but it's absolutely a struggle as we go forward. What I showed was that if you calculate a cost per year of life saved, it comes out to about $650,000, which is dramatically higher than what one would endorse for any kind of active medical therapy. What I did present was an interesting survey study, which was done of medical oncologists in Boston by Eric Nadler, who's now in practice in Dallas. And what Eric showed was when he interviewed oncologists that our threshold for an active therapy as oncologists was much higher. We considered $300,000 to be an acceptable threshold, whereas general internists and most healthcare economists will take $75,000, which is really the cost of dialysis, and that's how that's been costed out. So I think we as medical oncologists have a slightly more generous view toward what is cost effective. And one can see that if you can better refine the population, you certainly can get to $300,000 with cetuximab, I think, relatively quickly. The other thing we don't know is what the price would be. We're assuming that the price structure stays the same, and there's always a possibility that that could change over time.
You mentioned the issue of, quote, BEV eligibility. Where are we with that today? And specifically, maybe you can update us on the issues of brain mets, anticoagulation, and location.
So let's start with the easy one first, which is location. And I've always been someone who feels that you've got to be pretty strict with going along with what the treatment entry criteria were for AVAIL and for 4599. And location wasn't a criteria. And in subsequent reviews of who's gotten hemoptysis and who hasn't, a central tumor doesn't appear to really be a problem. I think we're learning that cavitation may be. So pre-therapy cavitation may turn out to be significant, but having something that's central or abutting the pulmonary artery or abutting the aorta in and of itself doesn't mean that that person can't get BEV. So I haven't used location as a criteria.
Before you get off of cavitation, what about cavitation that develops on therapy?
That's one of the big challenges, I think, in medical oncology today, which we did not talk about earlier, and I think is a real difficult problem. And what I've done is when someone has an enormous cavitary response, I generally stop their chemotherapy and BEV and watch and see how they do. Completely unevidence-based. I've just gotten nervous in that setting. But I think that's something we're going to need to spend some time looking into exactly how those patients do. Now, in a way, that's what you're hoping for. I mean, those cavitary responses are responses, and they're some of the best responses we see. But they are associated with an increased rate of hemoptysis, which is concerning.
What about the issue of brain mets and anticoagulation?
So I think if you look at all the BEV exclusion criteria, squamous cell being one, I think it's unlikely that we are going to be treating squamous cells with bevacizumab. Brain mets being a second, I think it's likely we will be treating brain mets. And we have some data at ASCO this year, principally presented by Wally Ackerley, where they looked at patients who were on the ATLAS trial, which is a trial of chemotherapy plus bevacizumab in lung cancer, as well as patients who are part of the Genentech-sponsored trial specifically to look at brain met patients. And in patients who've had their brain mets irradiated, who then have a period of recovery from the radiation, that group of patients seems to tolerate bevacizumab therapy with no rate of CNS bleed that's necessarily higher than the rate of CNS bleed in the general population. The data is preliminary, and we're still waiting, obviously, for the maturity of these studies. But thus far, I suspect the brain met patients will be able to benefit. And my group and I have treated a few selected patients with brain metastasis after having radiation therapy given to them. We're also learning a similar thing with anticoagulation. It appears that you can get away with anticoagulation as part of the approach to patients with lung cancer who are getting bevacizumab as well.
So does that mean, because I guess one of the questions has been, we know from AVAIL that people who require anticoagulation once you start treatment seem to do well, but do we have any data on people who start out on anticoagulation?
So that data is a little bit harder to come by, and I personally have been a little hesitant to use it in that setting. And the reason I say that is not just the anticoagulation, it's why were they anticoagulated? So most of my patients are anticoagulated because they have an acute thrombotic event. And I think that patient population is one that I've been hesitant to use bevacizumab in, i.e. the patient with a PE discovered a diagnosis, the patient who has some acute reason to be put on heparin. Now, if you're talking about a patient who's on Coumadin for AF, that's been on Coumadin for ages, my suspicion is that patient's probably fine. It's more the patient who's been acutely anticoagulated for clotting and for a DVT or a PE or a myocardial infarction or some other kind of issue.
What about other history in terms of arterial events, recent, you know, MIs, being treated for hypertension, age, and so how do these things affect you?
I think hypertension is not a problem. We've learned that we can manage this, and we can manage it well with antihypertensives. So I don't use hypertension as a criteria not to treat. Age is interesting. When one looks at the Rangalingam subset evaluation, which was published in the JCO, he found that patients over the age of 70 seemed to have more toxicity from bevacizumab-based therapy and less efficacy. I certainly agree with the more toxicity. I'm not entirely sold on the lack of efficacy. When you shrink the group to a smaller subgroup, it's harder to show a benefit. One has to be a little bit careful about reading too much into subset analysis. So I still offer bevacizumab to bev-eligible older patients. However, I do it with caution, and I do it with understanding that the side effect ratio might be slightly higher.
What about the controversial question of continuation of bevacizumab on disease progression and switching to another chemotherapeutic agent? This is a storm of controversy, particularly in colon cancer. What do we know about it in lung cancer?
So we're finding that that's, again, an emerging target, in that if one believes that bevacizumab makes chemotherapy better, the argument could be that bevacizumab will make second-line chemotherapy better and third-line chemotherapy better. We have data that we expect soon on the BETA trial, which is a randomized trial of either erlotinib or erlotinib plus bevacizumab. And if that trial is positive, I think you'll see more widespread use of bevacizumab in the second and third line. What that trial does not directly address, though, are patients who started on bevacizumab, so who got first-line bevacizumab, and then you face the question of, do you continue it? And so what I would say is, off-protocol, I have done this, but it's A, not FDA-approved as an indication, and there's no high-level evidence to support the use of continuing the bevacizumab. So one has to be a little bit cautious about doing that, and it really would only be in a selected patient population. There is one randomized trial that was published by Dr. Roy Herbst this past year where patients with second-line lung cancer were randomized between either chemotherapy or erlotinib, or either chemotherapy or erlotinib plus bev, and that showed that bevacizumab seemed to prolong progression-free survival in that setting. But it was a randomized phase 2 study, and it was small.
I meant to ask you before, I think we skipped over it. What about the issue of FISH testing for EGFR and how that might predict responses to cetuximab?
As we talked about earlier, I think that the biomarkers will be increasingly important in making cetuximab more cost-effective and in refining which patients should benefit from cetuximab therapy. And I think FISH is one of the more promising leads that we have right now. About 40 to 45% of patients will be positive for EGFR by FISH. And I think that looks like a great group of patients to test the hypothesis of whether or not this is the best way to select them. The proposed SWOG study will be powered to be able to ask the question of whether or not FISH-positive patients appear to have benefit. And that will be a predetermined upfront endpoint of the study.
Let's talk a little bit about the EGFR mutation story that you've been involved with for the last, I guess, what, 4 or 5 years. Maybe you can kind of update us a little bit on where we are with that. And also, in general, your work, your translational work. There's a paper just coming out right now in the New England Journal, a fascinating study looking at circulating tumor cells and markers on them. Where are we in general with translational work in non-small cell, including the mutation?
So I'd say a couple of things are interesting about that. The first is with the mutation story, that over the past 4 years, I think we've learned a couple of important things. One, we learned that mutation patients do benefit from upfront therapy with erlotinib or gefitinib. There was a trial that was published by our group in the JCO by Alicia Sequist, which showed that if you select patients upfront, you can have very nice overall response rates in excess of 50 to 55%. You can have median survivals in excess of 18 to 19 months and progression-free survivals of 10 to 11 months in the upfront setting with single drug therapy. So selecting patients upfront by mutation status appears feasible and appears active. Now, whether it's better than chemotherapy, we won't know till we have more randomized trial data. Second thing about mutations have been that we've learned about resistance and what makes patients resistant to upfront or erlotinib or gefitinib. And that is principally the presence of either c-MET amplification or a secondary mutation called T790M.
And what are those?
So c-MET is an oncogene which is an alternative way of signaling and activating PI3 kinase and activating the factors which tell a cell to grow. In mutated lung cancer, most of those signals are driven through EGFR. But if you have concomitant amplification of c-MET, even when you poison EGFR with erlotinib or gefitinib, you're still getting activation of PI3 kinase, so the cell's still growing. So c-MET is one target that we're going after to overcome resistance. T790M is a secondary mutation that changes the binding of Tarceva to the binding pocket and changes the competition for ATP binding sites, and that actually can make Tarceva or Iressa inactive in that setting. So overcoming T790M will be important as well. The good news for patients with mutations is we have about six or seven drugs that look like they might have activity in this particular setting.
In terms of c-MET and T790M, is this kind of just sort of a downstream type issue that it bypasses the mutation? Or not
so
really?
C-MET is downstream. It's a downstream issue. T790M makes erlotinib moot. So what happens is erlotinib will not compete for the binding pocket. So it's sort of like in GIST or CML when you change the binding pocket for Gleevec, it no longer works. And so you've got to find a slightly different drug to overcome that second mutation.
And is it still thought that the sensitivity of the patients with the tumors that have these mutations in some way is related to the binding to the EGFR TKIs?
I think that's part of it, but it's certainly not the whole story. And it's something that's emerging and evolving in terms of our understanding of resistance. IGF is probably also an important signaling mechanism. And so the IGF inhibitors, which look promising along with chemotherapy and squamous cell cancer, the IGF inhibitors will also be promising, I think, for overcoming Tarceva resistance in mutation patients.
What's the connection between IGF and the mutation or EGFR?
So Jeff Engelman, who's at our place at Mass General, Jeff has shown he's created cells that are resistant to ERISA by growing them in ERISA over a period of months. They eventually become to the point where you can put in industrial strength ERISA and you won't kill the cell. And what Jeff showed was that IGF signaling becomes important in those cells that have become resistant to ERISA. So if you can inhibit IGF, you can turn off the growth of these cells. And we're beginning trials, actually hopefully within the next 6 weeks, specifically looking at an IGF inhibitor plus Tarceva in patients with lung cancer.
What do we know about the tumors in patients who have the mutation, EGFR mutation, receive erlotinib or gefitinib, respond, but then progress in terms of what's going on in terms of resistance and what can be done about it?
So some of the difficult points that we've learned about resistance have been that it's not always uniform in terms of every patient's cell has exactly the same mechanism. Jeff Engelman and Passiani from Boston did a very nice paper where they looked at patterns of resistance. And in a patient with an autopsy sample, they found one patient that one area of tumor had a c-MET amplification, another area had T790M. So my feeling is that if we're going to overcome resistance, we're going to have to start early and we're going to have to use multiple therapies that can overcome each one of these paths of resistance, much the way we treat lymphoma. You know, we don't treat lymphoma with monotherapy with Cytoxan followed by monotherapy with Adriamycin followed by monotherapy with Rituxan and monotherapy with Vincristine. We do it together. And I think in lung cancer, the challenge is how do you put together four or five drugs, which is what I think it will take to overcome and to cure patients with EGFR mutated lung cancer.
Do you want to see an EGFR mutation assay in general in every one of your patients?
I think that for patients who are heavy smokers with squamous cell, I don't think EGFR mutation assays are all that helpful. Short of that, I think that for patients with adenocarcinoma or never smokers or light smokers, I think it can be very helpful. I think, Neil, one of the things we're about to begin is entering an era where we have far more information available to us in treating lung cancer. I think, as you've pointed out very nicely on several occasions, I think the breast cancer doctors have shown us the way with their dependence upon estrogen, progesterone receptor, and HER2 status to pick treatments, and increasingly their adoption of the Oncotype DX assay. And I think you'll be seeing more and more of that in lung cancer. I think at a minimum, RAS status, EGFR by FISH, EGFR mutation, EGFR by IHC, possibly RAF mutation status, possibly HER2. I think these will all be things that we could one day be looking at in lung cancer.
What are some of the other biologic agents that are coming down the pike that you think maybe could be a part of the standard care over the next few years?
So the class of drugs everybody's the most excited about, if you think about ASCO 2008, were the IGF receptor inhibitors. And probably the thing that made people most excited there was the idea of seeing something that actually worked better in squamous cell. Most of what you and I have been talking about today are therapies that help patients with adenocarcinoma. Squamous cell still remains an important type of lung cancer that we don't have a lot of fabulous treatments for. And the finding, or at least the suggestion from Dan Karp's group at MD Anderson, that giving chemotherapy plus an IGF inhibitor might actually improve outcome compared to chemotherapy alone, and that's justified a large phase 3 trial, I think is something people are pretty excited about in lung cancer.
What are your thoughts about 6474's Actemra How does it work, and where do you think it's heading clinically?
So Zactima is another drug that there's a great amount of interest in, and we hope to get results by the end of this year. Zactima is a dual kinase inhibitor, inhibits both EGF and VEGF. I tend to think that most of its activity comes from its VEGF activity, but it also does have some EGF activity as well. So Zactima is being looked at in two settings. One is compared to as monotherapy compared to Tarceva, large randomized trial being led by Ron Natale. And the second is in the setting of in combination with docetaxel in second line. And John Heymach is leading that trial where patients are randomized second line therapy to either get docetaxel alone or docetaxel plus Zactima. Personally, I have more hope that the docetaxel plus Zactima trial will be positive. I think it's a lot to ask of Zactima to be better than Tarceva, and I think that there's no reason to think that the toxicity profile will be all that different. However, I think the randomized phase 2s look pretty exciting with docetaxel, and this could end up being a new standard of care for second-line lung cancer if that's positive.
What do we know about the actual, you know, there are a lot of these TKIs out there that I guess we all try to think about as being very simple, but are maybe much more complex. So what do we know about the actual balance of impact in terms of this drug, in terms of EGFR and VEGF, and how that varies with the dose?
So I think, again, those are good questions. Much of this is based on highly preclinical modeling where they look at the affinity in these receptor assays, which is, you know, who knows what the relationship to that and actually giving it to a patient will be. So we get most of our information from that. The other thing you can derive a little bit from, which is that the side effect profile of a drug like Zactima, for example, tends to parallel that of a VEGF inhibitor. However, it does have some things in common with EGFR inhibitors, and it does cause rash. But I think you're right. I think that it's an imperfect science to be able to translate that completely.
What about sorafenib and sunitinib? We're starting to see some papers or some at ASCO recently looking at that. Where is that heading?
So I think with sorafenib, there's a great amount of disappointment this year when the randomized trial of chemotherapy plus or minus sorafenib didn't hit its primary endpoint and was closed. However, Joan Schiller presented at ASCO some interesting work looking at a randomized discontinuation study where patients who had stable disease with sorafenib were randomized to either stop the sorafenib or continue the sorafenib, and it found that the patients who continued the sorafenib appeared to do better before they progressed and had a longer period of time. Obviously, it's a randomized phase 2. It's not a definitive study. But I think that that's led people to be a little more excited that sorafenib could be an agent. Sutent, on the other hand, is something which may also turn out to be a third-line or fourth-line drug in lung cancer. We don't know yet about Sutent's role with chemotherapy. That has not been defined yet. But as a single agent, it appears that sutinib has about a 9 to 10% response rate, which is very close to what docetaxel and pemetrexed and Tarceva have.
What about side effects and toxicities?
I'm a little more concerned with the tyrosine kinase inhibitors in terms of side effects and that they all seem to cause fatigue and generalized malaise and other types of systemic symptoms. I think the antibodies are certainly cleaner in terms of their side effect profile than the small molecule inhibitors. And I think with Sutent, sorafenib, and AZD2171, these drugs tend to cause a similar type of fatigue. So I think it's something we have to watch carefully. If they prolong survival, we'll find a way to make the toxicity bearable, as our colleagues in renal cell have done.
What about the issue of maintenance therapy in the metastatic setting? There was an interesting study presented at ASCO looking at pemetrexed. Can you talk about that?
The lines are blurred, or increasingly being blurred, between first-line and second-line therapy in lung cancer. Traditionally, in the past, we had the paradigm of 4 to 6 cycles of therapy, give somebody a break. When they progress, go to second-line. What we learned from the pemetrexed study and from the FIDIA study using docetaxel last year was that if you give second-line therapy earlier in the course of patients, it appears the progression-free survival, and in the pemetrexed study, a strong trend for overall survival was also seen. So it may well be that the paradigm will shift and that we'll give first-line therapy for 4 cycles and then switch to early second-line therapy in that setting before progression actually occurs. The interesting thing which makes this even more complicated, though, is how do you then factor in maintenance antibody therapy? If we're going to be giving cetuximab and bevacizumab, how do you factor that into your maintenance strategies? There's also a large randomized trial which is looking at Tarceva as early second-line therapy. And so I think how we learn to integrate all of these is going to be challenging.
What about pemetrexed in the first-line setting?
I think, Neil, you're going to be seeing a lot more use of pemetrexed in first-line. Giorgio Scagliati presented data at the World Lung Cancer Conference last September in Seoul, Korea, which showed that patients were randomized between cisplatin and pemetrexed versus cisplatin and gemcitabine, and found that while the overall survival and progression-free survival is similar between the two drugs, in adenocarcinoma patients, which is the majority of what we see in the U.S., it appeared that pemetrexed was a superior agent.
It was interesting. I guess that just got published, and then there was an editorial that Larry Einhorn wrote about.
My feeling is that we know that the conclusions of the large study are that these drugs are similarly efficacious, and I think that you can certainly say that. So I don't think we're hurting our patients with adeno by giving them. And so I actually think that we will see the use of pemetrexed in first-line lung cancer, and it may be preferentially in adenocarcinomas.
What about pemetrexed with Bev?
We're learning now through some pilot studies that carboplatin, pemetrexed, and Bev appears tolerable, and I think we're going to learn similar things with cetuximab and pemetrexed and carboplatin. So I suspect that there will be good evidence within the next 6 to 8 months to make doctors feel comfortable using those regimens first line. I don't believe we're exactly there yet, but I think we're close.
What about pemetrexed with radiation therapy in stage 3 disease?
So pemetrexed, the great advantage of pemetrexed with platinum or carboplatin or cisplatin with radiation is it appears that you can give it at full dose, which you really can't do with anything else other than etoposide. You can give full dose pemetrexed. So Dr. Govindan's group and others in the CLGB have done that in stage 3 disease, and it looks very promising. So it may well be that pemetrexed cisplatin or pemetrexed carbo replaces either carbotax or cis etoposide with radiation. Again, the data is still preliminary and it's early.
What about the paper that you were part of that just got published in the New England Journal? I thought that was fascinating. You had told me about this a few months ago, but then when I saw it in the paper, I'm like, whoa, that is interesting.
Yeah, so this is a very nice piece of work. We have a scientist. Really, there are two people who are the driving force behind this. Daniel Haber, who's a molecular oncologist who was the person who discovered the EGFR mutations being related to lung cancer responsiveness. And he teamed with a gentleman named Mehmet Toner. And Toner is an engineer and a physician. And Toner has a really interesting story in that he was hired to look for fetal cells in the maternal circulation as a way of bypassing the need for amniocentesis. And he wasn't getting very far because the cells really were very close in size. And Haber said to him, he said, you know, why don't you look for cancer cells in the circulation? They're much larger. They're much easier to find. And all the incredible work that Toner had done trying to get fetal cells was very nicely applied to this question of cancer cells. And what the device is, it's basically a credit card-sized device filled with small micropulses that are about 80 microns in diameter. And the micropulses are coated with an antibody that binds to an epithelial antigen. And the cells sort themselves based on the flow, the microfluidics through the card. And the larger cells tend to be shunted into one direction compared to the smaller cells. And it allows you to isolate circulating cancer cells. And the sensitivity of this appears to be about 3 to 4-fold greater than that of prior technologies. Now, the demonstration of circulating tumor cells is not new. It's been known for about 140 years from back in the 1800s when they found evidence of circulating tumor cells in postmortem patients. But what's new about this is just the sensitivity for picking them up. I think, Neil, the potential for this is extraordinary. The potential for early diagnosis of relapse, the potential for diagnosing nodules or masses in the lung or other parts of the body without needing to do an invasive biopsy. The potential for molecularly profiling patients. We've been able to show in the New England Journal paper that we can find and document EGFR mutations. We can find and document resistance patterns from cells. So it's still very early in development of this technology, and the technology needs to be scaled up so it can be done at every hospital in the country and make it easier to do clinical trials with it. But I think the potential is really tremendous.
Now, what about looking at specific markers on the tumor cells?
So we've been able to show that you can find EGFR mutations in circulating tumor cells. You can find PSA in circulating tumor cells. So you can find a number of important markers in the tumor cell to allow you to distinguish where it's coming from.
What do we know about the levels of these circulating tumor cells in response to therapy?
So they correlate very nicely with response to therapy, particularly in the EGFR mutated patients, where we have the most experience. We've been able to show that if you give Tarceva, you'll see a reduction in the number of EGFR mutated cancer cells. Interestingly, in virtually every patient with metastatic disease with solid epithelial tumors that we've looked for circulating tumor cells, we've found them. We haven't found them in all the early stage patients, but the metastatic patients all have some burden of circulating tumor cells that we've looked at so far.
Do you think this potentially could be used to screen for lung cancer?
So it's interesting. I'm not certain if it will be sensitive enough to pick up lung cancer when it's still in the quote-unquote stage one. So if you have a 1 centimeter or 2 centimeter nodule, will circulating tumor cells be sensitive enough to do that? I don't know. I think the kind of places where it might be is in prostate cancer. You know, maybe this would help. And again, we have no idea whether this will pan out. But maybe in prostate cancer, it would pick out the person who's got the Gleason 6 and is never destined to die of their prostate cancer versus the guy who might have a PSA that's still low but has a higher grade tumor, and maybe circulating tumor cells gives you some window into the biology of those men who are trying to decide, should I do nothing? Should I have surgery? Should I have radiation?
Let's talk about adjuvant therapy. What's come out in the last year that you think is important for docs in practice to know about?
So I think at ASCO this year, there was a lot of concern because the YALT study, which was the original study that got us enthusiastic about adjuvant therapy, suggested that with prolonged follow-up, the amount of non-cancer death in the group that received chemotherapy appeared higher. And at 7 years, the study no longer has a statistical significance. I don't think that necessarily changes my feeling about the benefit of adjuvant therapy. I think that what it does do, though, it makes me realize that long-term toxicities are something we need to consider and factor into it.
How are you approaching the decision about choice of chemotherapy right now in terms of the adjuvant setting?
The guidelines that are inherent in the current intergroup study, I think, are pretty good ones, which is I prefer cisplatin-based adjuvant therapies. And when I'm treating patients who are standard risk patients, I'll use cisplatin. The current trial allows cisplatin with either vonorelbine, docetaxel, or gemcitabine. I tend not to use vonorelbine, so I'll use either docetaxel or gemcitabine. I tend to think that cisplatin and docetaxel is a pretty well-tolerated regimen, but I also think the cisplatin gemcitabine is also a good regimen in this setting.
And so how do you make the decision?
I tend to use as my default cisplatin docetaxel because it can be given relatively easy one day every 3 weeks, and I think it's well tolerated by patients. I think there are patients, though, that we use carboplatin-based regimens on, and I think that while it's sometimes easy for people doing clinical trials and doing research to talk about the importance of cisplatin, I think in the real-world situation, when you're seeing people who are 76 years old and have a creatinine of 1.7 and maybe had an MI along the way and a CVA, you're not necessarily going to give that person cisplatin. So I think that there's more carboplatin used than people want to necessarily recognize.
What about the issue of adjuvant therapy in a patient with an EGFR mutation?
So we have a study ongoing now specifically looking at the role of erlotinib in EGFR mutated patients who have had their adjuvant therapy with chemotherapy or whatever. And that trial is open, and we're accruing to that study right now looking at the potential role of that. I think the big question you're going to ask me, I know you're going to ask me this anyway, so I might as well answer it, which is what do you do outside of the study in that setting? And I think you can make a rational decision to consider a treatment like this. We know the response rates are extraordinarily high. The problem is you don't know, A, what the side effects, long-term side effects are, and B, you certainly have no window into duration of therapy. I mean, look how long it's taken in breast cancer for the breast cancer docs to figure out what the optimal duration of hormonal therapy is. Do you do 2 months? Do you do 6 months? Do you do 2 years? Is 5 years best? 7 years? I don't know. I think we just don't know that at this point.
So what are you doing yourself?
Fortunately, the trial is fairly liberal in its inclusion criteria, and I'm encouraging all of our patients to do that. And it's 2 years of adjuvant or erlotinib at the doses. And we literally just started this trial about 4 months ago.
How do you think people are going to do in the adjuvant setting, you know, knowing that maybe they might be cured in terms of tolerating erlotinib for 2 years?
I think that's going to be challenging. I think that you look at how many women end up not taking tamoxifen because of side effects. I think that you're going to see a similar situation with erlotinib, which is far more toxic in my mind than tamoxifen. They get significant rash. Many people have loose bowels. It's not the easiest drug to tolerate.
You were part of a paper with Mario Lacouture, who's a dermatologist with a specific interest in the issue of dermatologic toxicity, particularly of biologics, particularly of EGFR agents. As you all put that paper together, what were some of the things that you thought were most important for docs in practice to know about?
Well, I can tell you one thing. I wish every doc had someone like Mario to work with, because it's unusual to find dermatologists with this kind of interest in the dermatologic manifestations of systemic therapies. Mario brought several things to the forefront in my mind. First is that you want to moisturize your skin as much as you can. It's one of the reasons, Neil, that men have more rash than women do from these drugs, is men don't traditionally use moisturizing products. He talked about that being very important. The second is how probably the single best thing we can do is use tetracycline-based treatments like doxycycline as a therapy. And it's interesting, doxycycline has anti-inflammatory activities as well as antibiotic activities. And he actually believes it's the anti-inflammatory activity of doxycycline that works in this setting. Mario also believes in starting early with these drugs, that the first hint of rash in patients, get them on twice a day doxycycline. Antibiotic scrubs and wash probably also have a role, and we use Cleosin ointments and Cleosin lotions as an antibiotic adjuvant to that. And sometimes when it gets bad, steroids, systemic steroids can be used.
That works.
And it can work to help this. In some very tough cases of rash, you have to dose reduce. But one of the things I found and one of the things I tell patients and doctors is that in patients who are really benefiting, the rash will burn out. It's not going to stay at that same level of intensity that you have the first 2 months. And if you can just get through that first 3 or 4 months, you know, I have patients who've been on gefitinib and erlotinib for 4 or 5, 6, 7 years, and the rash usually is tolerable by then.
Anything else that we haven't talked about?
I think the biggest unknown is going to be, and the biggest, you talk about unmet educational need as you're thinking about that next year or so, is this whole question of early second line versus maintenance and how you're going to integrate, particularly if the early second line Tarceva trial is positive. I think that's going to lead to us really not knowing and throwing a lot of paradigm changes into the way we treat cancer. And I don't see the obvious road out of that. I mean, I don't see a trial that's going to completely define how to do this. I think, yes, from the ATLAS trial, if giving carboplatin Taxol Bev followed by Bev and erlotinib is positive, that's pretty easy for the Bev-eligible group. And then what about cetuximab? How would you incorporate cetuximab maintenance with other drugs? And what if we use pemetrexed first line? You know, then all the early second line data of pemetrexed is not applicable any longer. So I think that's where the real challenging questions are going to come from.